Good evening, everybody. Welcome home, Judy.
Thank you.
I bet. Let's do introductions around.
Wendy.
Jeffrey.
Nico.
Yeah.
Ellie.
Marie.
Eric.
Paul. I'm with Ishri.
Judy.
Carmen. And Angie. So you haven't been here before.
Not here. You saw me at
Chikoji. At Chikoji. That's why you're familiar, but I don't see you here.
Yeah, I found out. Really? Right here? So I'm like, oh, this is great.
Is this close to where you are?
Yes.
Oh, they're nice. Nice. Yeah. Well, welcome. And Eric, you've been here.
I was here once about 6 months ago.
Yes. Yes. Welcome back. So we're still studying Vimalakirti Sutra. We're almost at the end. And we're at really sort of the essence of the teaching of the whole thing, even though it sounds like a fabulous fairy tale. It actually does have a basic point. And this chapter is about that basic point. It keeps coming up all the way through. It's really about form and emptiness, you could say. How can we live in a world in which form and emptiness are the same thing? How is this possible? And then, of course, it's extrapolated into how can we live in a world that is so ugly and so violent and so difficult, and yet we have experience in sitting us an entirely different kind of sense of the world. How is this possible? And how do we live with that? How do we get through the day? So this chapter is called by the man who did this translation, Actions of the Bodhisattvas. Thomas Cleary calls it a gift of teaching on the perishable and imperishable. Bodhisattva practice is what Zen is about. The original practices in Buddhism were based on trying to achieve enlightenment for each individual. And so the teaching went out into the world with Buddha's students, and they all spread the word of this wonderful teaching. And each person who absorbed the teaching were greatly moved and their lives changed. And they began to aim for transcending the world in the way that Buddha actually was doing before he sat down under the tree. So it's a curious development, really, that in broad strokes you could say that the same thing was happening until people realized that it was a very self-involved practice and a very individualistic practice, that the fate of the world and the existence of the world and the great suffering that goes on in the world wasn't being touched by those who were practicing. So the Chan and then Zen development was about developing a practice that led students, disciples, to give up transcendence and vow to stay here We say in Zen we don't know if we're going to go somewhere else when we die. And some famous Zen folks say, yes, we're going, and it's going to be other worlds, and it's eternal transmigration. Mostly we say we don't know. And that whatever that is, Buddha said, it doesn't matter. That what matters is what's happening right now, right here. He said it's like being struck by an arrow and then trying to analyze the arrow, what kind of wood it's made of and what the feathers are and all of that, when really extracting the arrow from oneself and becoming aware and present and available for the world is what's necessary. It's really what we're for. So at that time, Buddha was in beautiful gardens, Amara gardens, preaching the law. When the ground suddenly became broad and beautifully adorned, and all the persons assembled there took on a golden color. So we're plunging into another marvel. Ananda said to Buddha, "World-honored one, what's the reason for this auspicious sign?" And Buddha said to Ananda, "Vimalakirti and Manjushri, reverently surrounded by a great gathering of persons, have decided to come here. Therefore, the auspicious sign." And at that moment, Vimalakirti said to Manjushri, "Let's go together to see the Buddha and join the bodhisattvas in paying obeisance and making offerings." Manjushri said, "Let's do it." So Vimalakirti, employing his supernatural powers, proceeded to pick up the whole great assembly along with their lion seats. The great bodhisattvas were huge and sitting on huge lion seats, way, way high. And took them in the palm of his right hand and journeyed with them to the place where Buddha was. And then there was a lot of bowing and circling of the Buddha and a lot of gratitude and a lot of kings, heavenly kings, and all kinds of creatures also came along, as well as all this great crowd that had already been in Vimalakirti's little room. And they all bowed their heads at the Buddha's feet. And then the Buddha said to Shariputra, he said, "Did you see what was going on there? These great men, what they did?" And Shariputra said, "Yes." And Buddha said, "What did you think of it?" Shariputra said, "What I saw them do was incredible. My mind can't comprehend it." And then Ananda said to the Buddha, "World-honored one, this fragrance I smell is like nothing I've ever known. What fragrance is this?" And Buddha said, "This is the fragrance that comes from the pores of these bodhisattvas, because we know that they've already been to the world of fragrance and picked it up and soaked it in." So, Shariputra says it comes from the rice left over from the Buddha's meal that the rich man Vimalakirti had brought from the country, many fragrances. The pores of everyone who ate it at his house emit this kind of fragrance. Then Ananda asked Vimalakirti, "How long will this beautiful fragrant aroma last?" And Vimalakirti says, "Until the rice is digested." He said, "The power of the rice is such that it will be 7 days before it's digested. depending on who ate it, it might have been only digested a shorter time if people who ate it had a liberation of mind. If those who haven't yet set their minds on attaining enlightenment, if they eat this rice, they'll have set their minds on, they have to set their minds on that before they can digest it. So there are all these different reasons and different practices depending on where each bodhisattva's practice happened to be. If they've accepted the truth of birthlessness and eat this rice, they will have to advance to the place where Buddhahood is assured in the next birth. In other words, it's like the medicine called the superior flavor or flowing that remains undigested until all the poisons in the body of the person who takes it have been eliminated. This rice is the same. Only after all the poisons of earthly desires have been wiped out will it be digested. So that's the essence of it. To have received what we receive, it has to be digested. And there are different times and places and levels of that, as we know, because we live this in our life. It would be lovely if it were all just one fell swoop somehow and just made everything click into place, but it doesn't work as a click into place kind of thing. So Ananda was blown away. He said, "I've never heard of such a thing, world-honored one, to think that this fragrant rice can be used to do the Buddha's work." And the Buddha said, "Sure, just so. There are some lands, Buddha lands, where the radiant light of the Buddha is used to do the Buddha's work. Somewhere bodhisattvas are used to do the Buddha's work." And then he makes a long list of all the different places, different lands, different qualities of places. Gardens, groves, pavilions, and towers are used to do the Buddha's work. There are some where the 32 features and 80 characteristics of the body of the Buddha are used to do the Buddha's work. Somewhere empty space is used for Buddha's work. Living beings responding to these various agents are thereby led to undertake the practice of the precepts. And this is one of the mysteries of our life in practice, that we come to it inspired in various different ways. And I expect if we went all the way around just this small room, we would find many, many different kinds of inspiration that inspired us to take on practice. And yet, it's all part of the same Buddha land. Shimmering heat waves are used to do the Buddha's work. That's my favorite. Pure Buddha lands where tranquil silence, without words, without explanations, without purport, without cognition, without conditioning, does the Buddha's work. He said there's a gate known as the four devils and the 84,000 earthly desires. Living beings are wearied and belabored by these devils and desires. But the Buddhas use this method by which to do the Buddha's work. This is called the Dharma gate of entry to the teachings of all Buddhas. The actual weariness and belaboredness and the suffering of all beings is the gate. So then he describes many, many different Buddha lands. He said, if you look at the various Buddha lands, the land in them is varied, but there is no variation in the sky. And it's the same when you looked at various Buddhas. Their physical bodies are varied, but that is all. There is no variation in their unimpeded wisdom. The physical body, impressive features, lineage, precepts, meditation, wisdom, emancipation, insight, powers, fearlessness, etc., etc., teach and convert others to lead living beings to enlightenment, to purify the Buddha lands and assimilate the law of other Buddhas. All these are possessed equally by all various Buddhas. Therefore, they are called Samyak Sambuddha, perfectly enlightened Buddha. They are called Tathagata, thus come one. They are called Buddha, enlightened one. He said, I can't explain in detail the meaning of these three words because it would take me a million jillion years. It's beyond fathoming. Their wisdom and eloquence defy comprehension. And Ananda said, from now on, I'll never try to think of myself as a person who heard many of the teachings. And Buddha said, it's like I have spoken to you as if there were few leaves from a tree, but there are many, many more leaves that haven't been spoken. And so there's the depth of it and the continuity of it that we can't possibly begin to comprehend. But it's just like fate itself. If we consider the causes and conditions that go into every single second of our life, there are infinite causes and conditions. Or even our own individual life that came from a very persistent sperm and a particular egg, but they each came from sperms and eggs, and they came from etc., etc., all the way back to Lucy, before Lucy. It's huge. So the Buddha said to Ananda, don't be discouraged, because when I spoke of you as foremost among the voice hearers in the volume of teachings you've heard, I wasn't speaking with the bodhisattvas in mind. So don't take the matter to heart, Ananda. He said, no wise person should try to estimate the abilities of the bodhisattvas. All the deepest places in the sea can still be fathomed, but the meditation, wisdom, power of bodhisattvas are immeasurable. So he said, forget you and the others. You'd best forget about the actions of the bodhisattvas. This manifestation of supernatural power that Vimalakirti has just now shown us, no voice hearer or Prajñāka Buddha could equal in 100,000 kalpas. So the bodhisattvas from many fragrances decided then to leave, go back home. And they said, world-honored ones, when we first saw this land, we thought it as base and inferior. You know, they came from a perfect world, a beautiful, fragrant world, and they were really kind of disgusted by this Saha world. He said, it was an error, and we put our such thoughts out of our minds because the expedient means employed by the Buddhas are beyond comprehension. In order to save living beings, they manifest different kinds of Buddha lands depending on what is appropriate to the circumstances. Very well then, world-honored one, we would like you to bestow a little of your teachings on us, so when we return to our own land, we will have something to remember the thus come one by. It's like leaving a tea or something, you know. Thank you very much, and could you leave us a little something? The Buddha announced to the Bodhisattvas, there is the doctrine of the exhaustible and the inexhaustible emancipation. You would do well to learn this. Exhaustible means those things that are constructed or conditioned. Inexhaustible means those things that are unconstructed or unconditioned. Being such as the Bodhisattvas do not exhaust or have done with the conditioned, nor do they dwell in the unconditioned. In other words, the Bodhisattva stays here, and yet cultivates practice. And in cultivating practice, is able to see through what we call here, the Saha world, as not the same as ordinary mind sees it. He explains that not exhausted by the conditioned is not setting aside great compassion, not renouncing great pity, and just doing whatever one possibly can to make things better for oneself and for everyone. It looks on the meditational states as they were hell, it says, a form of hell, but the realm of birth and death as though contemplating a garden. In other words, don't fall in love with Zazen and ignore the world as some ugly place. That there's a balance, and the balance takes a discriminating mind, a careful mind, a clear mind that's able to see through our visceral reactions to things and our mistaken view of how things are. So he says, just use the teaching and be in the world using the teaching. And don't get carried away by either side. You can accommodate worldly ways, even with proper demeanor, calling up transcendental powers and wisdom and using them to guide everyone. He says, one studies and practices the teachings on emptiness, but does not take emptiness to be enlightenment. No feeling, not getting stuck in the feeling of emptiness. I mean, that's very tempting. It's just as tempting to get caught by emptiness as it is to be caught by ordinary life. And the point here is to find a balance in one's mind and not be attached to any of it. But to use the clarity of our mind in order to enact our life just from where we are, without a story, and using any means necessary. So there's nothing to be ashamed about, because there are all sorts of situations that are kind of sticky and weird, and we get caught up in them, but those too are helpful and part of how we use our life as mulch, I think Chogyam Trungpa said. It's maybe like the fragrant rice, it's feeding us, it's nourishment. So the bodhisattvas, of course, hearing all this teaching, were thrilled and scattered flowers all over the whole thousand millionfold world and exclaimed, Shakyamuni Buddha knows how to employ expedient means in a truly skillful manner. So this is all about expedient means. The whole teaching is how to accept the world and use the world as it is, as the teaching and as a teaching, and use our practice as the teaching, that they're not separate. It's the same thing. Form is emptiness, and emptiness is form. We can't think it, but we can live it. We do live it, just as it is. So are there questions? Paul?
This is telling me is that when you have that experience of emptiness, the next year or two, however long it takes to digest it, you're going to stink.
Yes.
That's what I thought.
Yes.
You're
going to stink.
Stink. Stink. Going to smell. People can get near you and go, ooh, emptiness. Yeah.
You're smelly.
When you reach balance, you don't smell anymore. You're okay. It might take a while.
Yeah.
Well, it's nice to hear because there's so much going on in the world right now, and we get so wrapped up in it that we just keep repeating the story over and over to each other. And we get wrapped up in it that we just completely forget that there's another side.
Yes.
Of that.
Yes.
And if we can just go to that and stay away from just getting caught up and wrapped up in the drama of the whole world, it would become very, you'll have that fragrance where somebody else would like that same fragrance too. Yeah, and would like to digest faster. But if only we just know this, considering what we know now after hearing what you said, that would be pretty nice, you know, if we could just leave this room and just move on to just finding the fragrant part of ourselves rather than get caught up with all the stories that's being thrown on the internet and the news that go on is not so great. You know, we fester in it. You're right, we stink. Yeah.
On that side too, we can stink on either side. We can stink on the enlightenment side or on the everyday life side, depending on how we see. Mm-hmm. it's really a view. And it's a choice, the view that we take. But it's also based on experience. And the experience is in terms of the enlightenment side or the emptiness side, it's the experience of sitting. So having sat for long enough, we begin to sense that there's more to this world than just what we read in the newspapers or see on TV. A lot more, and that we need to use the new information that we have with our practice to have a better, more clear view of the world so that there's something for us to do about it instead of just feeling miserable. Which is so tempting to do. Oh, I can't, what can I do? But we can do a lot right here where we are. And that's all we can do. So it's a great teaching. It's the truth. Thank you. As what?
Skillful means?
Yes.
On one hand, I understand it, but how does that actually work in the real world? You know, because like, okay, I'm in this story, it's easy to forget this, that the Malakirti is only pretending to be sick. You can call that dishonest, but it's also expedient because it worked. You know, everybody came. But then again, in the real world, I can look and say, well, expediently, this is the way to proceed, but because it just kind of somehow seems to make sense that we'll get through the this neck of the forest if we go this way.
Yeah.
But if we go this way, there are other issues, you know, in the real world that get neglected. And one person's expediency is another person's oppression.
Exactly.
How does that work?
Well, that's why we have the precepts.
Even with the precepts, we're kind of trying to operate on good faith.
Yes. That's the operative word. Trust. You could call it trust. Actually step off the edge of everything and trust.
That's what it seems like it adds up to. But
that's the truth of it.
But what it adds up to is it's a form of emptiness thing. It's like it adds up to this and makes sense, but it really doesn't make sense.
Well, you know that wonderful story about the guy who fell off a cliff and grabbed on to the root and was holding on for dear life, and there was a hungry tiger down below. And he was losing his grip, but there was a little strawberry, and he picked it and ate it, and he thought, oh, this is so good. It's sort of like that. Yeah. Well, it's 8 o'clock. We have announcements. We have a whole day sit coming up, don't we?
Right, Saturday the 10th, we're going to be sitting here from 9 to 4. It's an open day where you can come for a few sits or the whole day. You take a 1 hour break at noon for lunch, and Angie gives the Dharma talk at 1. So you're welcome to join us. That's here on the 10th, Saturday, the 10th, 9 to 4.
Okay. Let's have 1 minute sit.